Our next speaker is Kieran Gillian-Lee. Kieran is one of the very few people who is an expert in both quantum foundations and classical causal inference. So Kieran, take it away.
Thanks, Rob. So hello, everybody. My name is Kieran, as Rob said. So today I'm going to give you a quick overview of two recent kind of new causal inference algorithms that we've developed at the Causal Inference Lab at Spotify Research, try and answer some causal questions that we're faced with every day when we deal with the kind of Spotify relevant data. But before I dive into that, I just kind of want to give one quick motivating example to hopefully illustrate, you know, why causal inference is so important for decision making in the real world. And I guess as an aside, how we managed to convince an industrial company to fund research in causal inference. So let me go straight onto that. Perfect. Okay, so here is a screen grab of a kind of Twitter post that this individual posted just after kind of vaccinations for COVID-19 had kind of been rolled out around the world. And what he's done is he's gotten off the Office of National Statistics data in the UK. And because he didn't really believe the vaccines were kind of effective, what he did is he just plotted the number of deaths among vaccinated population and the number of deaths among the non-vaccinated part of the population. And he noticed a kind of strange trend that maybe kind of goes against what we've all heard about, you know, how, you know, efficient vaccines are and so forth. So the orange line here are the part of the population who has been vaccinated, and the blue line is those who have not been vaccinated. We see a strange trend in that the people who have been vaccinated have a higher mortality rate than people who have not been vaccinated. So this seems to kind of be counter to, you know, the fact that we have these randomized control trials which show vaccines work and so forth. So what's going on here? And so the kind of strange thing about all this was that it comes from the Office of National Statistics. You just go online, find this data. It was right there. And the main thing that we see from this graph is that, you know, in some sense, this data seems irrefutable, right? The death rates among vaccinated people are higher than unvaccinated people. So this led this kind of person on Twitter to, you know, ask whether vaccinating an entire population was the right policy, let's say. So, you know, as hardened causal inference experts, I think you all know what's going on here. It's a classic example of Simpson's paradox. So the kind of, you know, brief way to kind of summarize this is that the average unvaccinated person is much younger than the average vaccinated person, at least at the time that this data was kind of being rolled out and so forth. And the reason for that, especially in the UK, was that, you know, older cohorts were allowed to get vaccinations earlier. So this is kind of why there's this imbalance in the data. But because, you know, younger people hadn't been vaccinated the same levels that kind of older cohorts people had been, that meant that, you know, that's explaining this low mortality rate in a sense. So any benefit from the vaccines is kind of swamped by the increase in mortality as people get older in some sense. So all of this to say that age is a confounder, you know, between both receiving vaccinations due to the kind of rollout policy in the UK, and also age is something that influences mortality as you get older. Unfortunately, things get a bit kind of more difficult and so forth. But what's cool is that once you control for age, right, just by bucketing people into different age brackets and looking at the association between vaccination status and mortality within each bucket, then this association flips back to what we would expect it to be. So the main kind of take home from this is that had we done any action or policy change based just on the raw correlations that we could have extracted from the Office of National Statistics in the UK, you know, such as whether to continue a vaccination policy rollout in the UK, this would not have increased kind of survival of the population. So the main take home that I kind of want to like stress from all this is that, you know, relying on correlations extracted from observational data, as we all know, can lead to embarrassing, costly, or kind of dangerous mistakes. And this isn't just an isolated incident. There was many cases throughout COVID where the same types of kind of like mistakes in reasoning were kind of rolled out. The Daily Mail, for instance, had a headline that said smoking seems to prevent kind of bad impact from COVID. The same newspaper had a headline saying that baldness is associated with reduced risk from COVID. And all of this was examples of Simpson's paradox, of Bergson's paradox and so forth, just highlights the need to kind of really dive deep and understand the causes and effects underlying the data generation process so that we can reason kind of correctly. So why is this kind of problem important for Spotify? So usually, you know, the kind of gold standard is for us to use randomized control trials, which are called A-B tests in kind of industry to kind of reason about cause and effect. But much of the time, A-B tests can't actually be performed. For instance, they could be too damaging to a user experience. They could be technically too hard to implement. So if we want to figure out whether, you know, your app crashing causes users to leave the service, then we'd have to force some users' apps to crash, which if we think it's a bad thing, we shouldn't really be rolling that out. Moreover, if we want to figure out if, you know, listening to podcasts or audiobooks causes people to stay on the platform longer, right? Because these are interesting new types of content for them to enjoy and discover, we'd have to remove podcasts or audiobooks from some part of our kind of user base. And again, if we think it's a good thing, we can't really do that. And moreover, it's kind of technically hard to have these holdouts run for a very long time. So the great thing about causal inference is that it gives us a set of methods and tools for learning about quantifying cause and effect, even when we don't have A-B tests, you know, given some assumptions and so forth. And so this is why it's such a kind of important thing for a big company if they want to understand what decisions they should make now in order to affect change in the future. But there's many kind of issues where we have more kind of, let's say, nuanced causal inference problems presented to us by the type of data we have available at Spotify. So for instance, you know, in many applications, only a single intervention is possible at a given time. Or interventions are applied one after another in a sequential manner. But much of the data that we have access to, interventions are kind of applied concurrently all at once in some sense. So, you know, this also happens in many other fields and, you know, medicine, patients may possess many comorbidities. And so we have to kind of understand how to treat both of them at the same time with multiple prescriptions to reduce symptom severity. Computational advertising, people might be targeted by multiple campaigns at the same time. And during the pandemic, for instance, you know, many interventions were applied simultaneously in some sense, mask wearing, working from home, closure of schools and so forth. So the big question coming from all this is, how do we learn the individual effect of each intervention had it been applied on its own instead of in conjunction with other interventions and so forth? So this is the kind of formalized way of stating that problem. So suppose I have, you know, observational data, but also I have joint interventional data. The main question we kind of want to ask is, how can we use these two types of kind of data to learn or identify the conditional average causal effects of single interventions? So just to really kind of drive home what's going on here. What we're given is this observational data and joint interventions, but what we want to learn is interventions on one of those kind of variables and observations on one of the other ones. And this can be tricky because interventions can, you know, interact in non-trivial ways and so forth. So for instance, if, you know, if we consider the example of computational advertising, it could be that you're sent two promotions on the same day. And, you know, even though the second promotion is showing you something that perhaps you might like to buy or listen to or engage with, the mere fact that you're sent a second promotion is so annoying to you that it's going to cause you to not take that action. So there's this interaction between treatments that can occur, and that's what makes this kind of problem quite difficult. So just to kind of reiterate what's going on here is that when we say identifiable, what we just mean is, you know, a quantity is identifiable from a specific type of data. If every model that agrees on that specific type of data produces the same value for the quantity that we want to identify. So another way of flipping this around is kind of saying that if two models agree on the data, but not on the quantity, then that quantity is not identifiable from the data alone. So let's see, in general, is it even possible to identify single variable interventions from joint interventions and observations? So here's an example showing that it's, yeah, as people may have guessed, not identifiable in general. So here are two models, M and M prime, two variables, X1, X2, the outcome variable Y, X1 and X2 cause Y. In model M, X1 also causes X2. But in model M prime, there's no causal link from X1 to X2. And here, what we're doing is the U's are meant to be the noise terms for each variable, but we're kind of going to allow unobserved confounding going on here, which just means that these noise terms are correlated. And for the purpose of this example, we're assuming that these noise variables are perfectly correlated with one another. So how the example kind of works is that, you know, well, first to note, all variables are binary. But when we look at what's going on here, observationally, the models look the exact same. Well, all functional dependencies are the same, apart from the functional dependence of X2. But when we kind of realize that U1 equals U2 and X1 is equal to U1, well, then when we input that in model M, we're just multiplying U1 by U2, which is the same as multiplying U1 by itself. And as these are bits, that just kind of gives back that variable again. And so that shows us that observationally, model M and model M prime are the exact same. So they agree on that observational data. Moreover, because Y functionally depends on X1 and X2 in the exact same way, jointly intervening on X1 and X2 provides the same outcome for Y. So these two models agree observationally and they agree on joint interventional data, But when we look at kind of intervening on X1 alone and just looking at observations on X2, then these two models start to disagree with one another. And the main reason you can kind of see this is that in model M, X2 causally depends on X1, whereas on M prime, this is not the case, even though observationally they look the same. And so this kind of shows us that observations and joint interventions are not enough on their own to fully constrain single interventions. So all this kind of means that we need to kind of find more assumptions if we want to kind of prove identifiability, and it'll be in this reduced kind of model class. So here is one model class in which full identifiability is possible, and perhaps the assumptions aren't too strong. So here what we're looking at, the causal structure is kind of given on the right-hand side. And what we're assuming is that there's this kind of additive noise structure going on. So Xi is a, you know, function that depends on some observed confounder, which is C here. And the way it also depends on some unobserved confounder is then additive to the way in which it depends on C. And Y might kind of, you know, depend on both C and the observed confounder in some sort of nonlinear, you know, arbitrary functional way. But the way it has to depend on the unobserved confounder has to be additive. So all this to kind of say that we're making this assumption, but still there's some sort of, you know, difficulty in this problem, right? Because all the x's can interact together through this function fy to give rise to y, and it can be nonlinear and quite complicated. But the way in which the confounding influences everything that's going on has to be additive. And once we make that additivity assumption in relation to the unobserved confounder, then we get full identifiability here. But it's still a non-trivial kind of functional model class and kind of, you know, occurs lots of time in the real world, because when we're making measurements with data lots of the time, there can be, you know, additive noise terms because our, you know, measurements of the way in which we're collecting data isn't super accurate. So the additivity isn't the most unreasonable thing in this situation. But nevertheless, when we weaken this additivity assumption, you can check our paper, that identifiability starts to fail almost instantly. So it's, you know, quite specific on this type of class. Okay, so we have the full identifiability, which means that it's possible to learn these things. But the next question is, how do we learn these things if I just give you a big data set? And given the structure in the identifiability problem, we can look at the expected value of the Y that we want to learn given one of the single interventions. And it breaks down into this kind of quantity on the left-hand side here. And this proposes a kind of, you know, a learning process called the expectation maximization style. So the first kind of step is we'll fix some unobserved distribution for the confounder, arbitrary, it could be Gaussian, something like this. So we fix that and we try and, given that, learn the function Y. And then we iterate again, fix the function Y we learned in the previous section, update the distribution over the unobserved confounder so that it kind of better fits the data, and kind of iterate through this process again and again until we get some stop criterion that gives us the kind of maximizes the kind of log likelihood in this kind of situation. You can check the paper for the kind of full details, but we kind of, in our paper, went to kind of check, does this approach work on real world data? And kind of, does it do better than, you know, other approaches that might kind of be applied in this situation? So we took data from the International Stroke Trial database. So this is a large randomized trial that lasted for 14 days. And it looked at various ways to kind of treat the onset of stroke. And so in this case, there are two possible treatments, aspirin dosage or heparin dosage. And what we did was we took that initial data and then we kind of created a kind of composite outcome based on things happening in those 14 days that kind of give us a value in the kind of continuous interval 0 to 1 that just predicts the likelihood of recovery from stroke given the specific kind of dosage of each of these treatments. And the goal was to see, okay, can we still learn the individual impact of these treatments, even though we can ramp up confounding? So what we did was we created a synthetic confounder, added it to the data, and then increased its correlation and tried to see, okay, as we increase the impact from this unobserved confounder that we have control over, can we still estimate the individual impacts of each of these dosages? We have the individual impacts of these dosages because there was another held out kind of data set here where some patients just got one or the other. So we know what the kind of true answer is, even though we didn't use data from that in our model. So on the right-hand side, you can kind of see what's going on as you're increasing the covariance with this unobserved confounder, our ability to kind of figure out what's actually going on when compared to the actual ground truth using our model, which is in green here, is very good. But for other models, for instance, just trying to do standard regression using neural networks and so forth, we're always off by quite a large order of magnitude, and that is increasing in some sense as the strength of confounding increases. So this seems to work on kind of, you know, given the variances, you know, existing in real world data, it seems to give, you know, robust estimation in this case. So if you're interested in kind of reading more, the paper is kind of at that archive link. We have a little blog post on the Spotify research blog that kind of gives us an overview and more kind of intuitive detail. But if you're interested, you can go and kind of view there. And so the main question you might be asking is, you know, what are examples of this specific problem at Spotify? Well, there is a kind of range of examples. Two of the kind of most prominent are the fact that, you know, if you ever go onto the Spotify homepage, you're bombarded with many different types of content to kind of consume. So it could be playlists, could be albums, could be podcasts, could be audiobooks and so forth. And they're all recommended on top of each other in different categories and so forth. And if we want to figure out the individual impact of a specific either item of content or content category, you know, is for this user, did they enjoy listening to podcasts more than music? If so, we should increase the amount of podcasts that we should recommend to them and so forth. So if it's causing good user engagement, we should kind of increase that and so forth. So we want to kind of, given all this kind of joint interventional data, disentangle so we can figure out the impact of each one on its own and then figure out the right treatment for that specific listener of Spotify, let's say. Another kind of on the flip side is if instead of looking at users of Spotify, if we look at artists on Spotify, there's a range of actions that artists themselves can take to kind of build their fan base. You know, they can release albums, they can do promotional campaigns, they can go on tour, and all these things kind of happen within very kind of short time periods. And in order to kind of figure out the individual impact of all these actions, find the right, let's say, sequence or combination of those actions for a given artist, we need to disentangle it first. From that, we can then kind of, you know, recommend to an artist the right things they should do to grow their fan base. There's many more examples, but they're kind of two of the kind of main ones that inspired this kind of work in the first place. Cool. Okay, so on to the second problem that's kind of, you know, routinely occurs with the data we have available to us at Spotify. So the last example dealt with a case when we couldn't do A/B tests and kind of complications that could arise there if we had multiple interacting treatments. But even when we can use A/B tests, they usually have relatively short durations due to cost considerations. So, you know, usually we can't run them for more than a week or 2 weeks, something like this. And the kind of upside of this is that it makes learning long-term causal effects really hard to do in practice. And because, you know, short-term outcomes are generally quite different to long-term ones. You know, if you see a new album coming out from your favorite artist, you might listen to it a huge amount in the following 2 weeks. But 6 months later, you probably don't listen to it as much as you did in that first 2 weeks. So the short-term impact and the long-term impact are usually quite different. And in general, we can't use the short-term impact on its own to predict what the long-term impact is likely to be and so forth. But they're really kind of important to kind of understand these longer-term impacts. You know, technology companies, we want to understand the impact of deploying a new feature on longer-term, you know, 6 month, 1 year engagement with the platform. Economists are interested in dealing with the long-term impacts of job training programs, right? Because you want someone to still be employed 1, 2, 3, 4 years after attending a program. Doctors, as we saw in the past example, are interested in, you know, looking at the long-term impacts of medical interventions, you know, that people, you know, have their symptoms reduced over longer periods of time rather than immediately on kind of taking the intervention. So all of this means, how do we kind of figure out how to take short-term experiments and figure out what their long-term impact might be? So here's a kind of way to formalize this problem. So here we have a DAG, we have, you know, an initial treatment X, we then have some sort of mediator M, and then we have a longer-term outcome Y. And the kind of goal here is that if we're given experimental samples, so samples from some sort of randomized control trial or A/B test between variables X and M, and moreover, we have historical observational samples that, you know, we've looked at over the past number of years from people doing these actions between X, M, and Y, the question is, can we estimate the causal effect of X on Y? And to do that, we need to figure out what the causal effect of M on Y is. And this is kind of confounded by the fact that there can be an unobserved confounder W going on here. So in the experimental sample, the unobserved confounder will be kind of removed because that's the whole point of doing randomization. But in the observational sample, which could be from a different distribution and so forth, the unobserved confounder is kind of still present. So we need to find a way to kind of remove that. So here's a kind of way to think about this in a slightly more concrete way. So suppose, you know, X is some dosage of a specific drug, M is the symptom severity after about 2 weeks of taking that drug, and Y is the symptom severity after about 6 months. So if we have historical observations, you know, involving X, M, and Y from maybe a different population, and we're given samples from a recent experiment on a certain, you know, perhaps different population again, between people taking certain dosages and the symptoms a short time after that, can we combine this experimental sample with the observational one to kind of estimate the severity of symptoms after 6 months for the people who are in the experiment? So as we said, the issue with this is that the observational samples can be confounded. And, you know, because they're samples from different distributions, potentially, we don't observe the long-term outcomes for those units in the experiment. We need to predict them, even though they could be from different distributions and so forth. So how do we do this? So here's a kind of simplified example to kind of talk through our solution to this problem. So we're assuming a linear Gaussian model here, where everything has kind of, you know, Gaussian noise terms and everything depends on each other in some sort of linear way. And so in this case, you can kind of see the kind of the parameters from our linear models depicted on the graph. So you can kind of see the influence of each arrow and so forth. So if we kind of simplify this problem a little bit and we want to kind of figure out, okay, let's remove this kind of annoying arrow from the unobserved confounder to that mediator, which was present in the initial kind of formulation of the problem. We're back to the front door structure that everyone knows and loves. And we know in this case, you know, we can estimate the effect of X and Y, even though there's unobserved confounders, because we have a mediator that's not connected to it. So the kind of standard way to solve this is to first regress M, the mediator, on X. That gives us C. And then if we also regress Y on M and X, that gives us A. We just then multiply A and C together, and we have the effect of X on Y. So that's the kind of standard door approach. But we can kind of change this slightly and provide a new estimator in the front door case when we consider linear Gaussian models, and that this new kind of version will be kind of more amenable to generalization to the case when Y is a cause of M. So instead of the standard kind of approach, let's try something new. So we estimate C as before, just regress M on X. But now in order to kind of figure out what A is, what we do is we regress M on X and we compute its residual. So the bit, you know, that kind of tells us how M kind of responds that's independent of X. And as we see from the kind of DAG here, that intuitively is, you know, the noise term on M, NM. But what's interesting here is that we can actually use NM as an instrumental variable to figure out what the impact of M on Y is. And so this kind of, you know, intuitively you can kind of see how this works, but we just use M to kind of figure out what A is by using it as an instrumental variable. Cool. Okay. So that's how it works in the front door case. So you have this nice new way of kind of dealing with that problem there, using kind of residuals from regression terms and treating them as instruments for instrumental variable regression. But when we do the same approach in our more general problem, when W causes M, we don't get the noise term because, you know, there's a direct cause here. So these things are correlated in some sort of non-trivial way. But what we actually can do in this case is to use the experimental samples between X and M to actually remove this bias, which seems in some sense, you know, difficult to do, but it's interesting that it kind of works. So what we do here is we figure out what this causal effect of X on M is. We get C that comes from our experiments. We have that available to us. And we use C in this kind of formula on the left-hand side here for a new instrument. So again, we regress M on X, get the residual. What we do is then we construct this other term and subtract it from what this residual is. And it turns out that doing this, subtracting this very specific quantity that involves the impact of X on M, which is C here, allows us to kind of learn a variable that's independent of W, which is cool because then that means it's an instrumental variable. And again, we can use this as an instrumental variable to determine what A is. And you can look at the details in our paper that proves this kind of works, that, you know, this quantity here is independent of W, and we can use it as an instrument. And moreover, that this using this instrument gives us an unbiased way to estimate A, given all the assumptions we've specified thus far. So again, we can kind of test this out on some real data to see kind of how it works. And again, we're going to use the International Stroke Trial database here. So again, we kind of changed things slightly. What we wanted to do is we took the initial 14 days of randomized control trial that kind of looked at when certain individuals were kind of treated with a certain dosage, and what their impact was at the end of the 14 days. We then constructed some synthetic data in the kind of right way with some unobserved confounder, which was age in this case, to try and predict, okay, from that sample, what's the longer term impact? And we compared this to kind of the standard way of doing this that was known in the literature that wasn't aware of these unobserved confounders. And on the right-hand side, we kind of plot this for various different values of, you know, the variance in our data set, the impact or how strong the mediator M depends on the unobserved confounder. Our method is the kind of solid line, and previous methods are the dashed lines. You can see in all kind of cases for the different colors, which are these different variances, we reduce bias in this estimation. But because this data set maybe isn't linear, it's not always perfect unless the influence from the unobserved confounders to the mediator is small. But in all cases, it reduces bias, so definitely does a better job at giving us an idea, or at least an upper bound on what the impact from these things is at a longer term, which enables us to reason in kind of, you know, situations of uncertainty and so forth. So again, the paper is there at this archive link. We have another nice blog post because, you know, the PR team always likes these types of things. So if people are interested, go and have a look kind of there. The full details are in the paper. So the last thing I kind of want to say before wrapping up is that these two problems that I've discussed, you know, interacting simultaneous treatments and, you know, figuring out longer term impacts and so forth, deal with interventions on their own, right? So in Pearl's kind of causal inference hierarchy, they would sit at Rung 2, which just deals with interventions. But Pearl has kind of shown us that there are different types of causal queries that we can ask that in some sense are more general than just interventions. And so, you know, the kind of main question we might ask are, you know, are these counterfactuals from this top layer of the hierarchy, are they useful in practice at all? It seems like, you know, naively, just understanding the impact of interventions is kind of almost good enough for all practical purposes, right? If I want to figure out what decision should I take now to impact change in the future, I just deal with interventions. So are counterfactuals any use? You know, these are terms that kind of have, you know, we observe some data initially and we say, okay, counter to that observation, what would have happened had some precondition been different and so forth. So perhaps they're not as useful, but in some kind of recent papers, we've shown that indeed there are many problems that can be formulated as full counterfactual inference problems, and that treating them as such gives us an advantage, especially in personalized decision making over just interventions on their own. So I won't go into these in too much detail, given the kind of length of time I should speak for today. But the first one is all about kind of framing medical diagnosis as a full counterfactual inference task. It turns out that this results in kind of expert clinical accuracy when compared to a cohort of doctors. You know, when we compare that to just standard observations, standard deep learning, and also interventions. And in a more recent kind of paper, what we did was we took that kind of insight and we found lots of different kind of real-world problems that having a counterfactual inference approach gives a much more kind of nuanced and accurate kind of decision-making than we would have achieved otherwise. But the main insight for this one is that the previous paper, we had a big model that was built from doctors' domain knowledge about what caused what the, you know, probabilities for different outcomes were in some sense. And so we had a model given to us and we just figured out how to do causal reasoning on top of that model. But this paper combined kind of causal inference with deep learning techniques and showed that given this raw data, we can figure out some assumptions that would kind of enable us to learn causal models from this data, and then how to do efficient causal inference or counterfactual inference with these using deep learning and so forth. So that paper is kind of there for people who are maybe interested. And the last thing to say is, you know, doing all that research might be nice, but why would counterfactuals be interesting or useful for Spotify? Well, there's many examples, two of which are kind of the following. So one might be what playlists should we update? So we have a whole, you know, kind of group of editors at Spotify who build these playlists. They choose what song should come after what song and so forth. And these are the things that we can recommend to users to really keep them engaged with different artists and enjoying music and so forth. But editors have loads of playlists to update, you know, what song should I take away? They've been there too long. Should I switch the order of these songs and so forth? Some of them have 50 playlists to kind of manage, which means they can't get to it every week. They can't look through all the playlists and see which one should be updated. So we built a model for them to kind of figure out what playlist they should update in the given week. And you can phrase this as a counterfactual problem, because you want to kind of choose to update playlists that both updating them will improve them, but moreover, not updating them will kind of cause some bad outcome. Because in principle, updating a playlist should always make it slightly better if the editors are good at their job. So if we just figured out what the intervention of updating a playlist was, then that would kind of probably tell us to update every playlist. But we're happy to leave a playlist if updating it now will keep it as it is. We only want to update them that if not updating them will lead to a bad outcome. And moreover, updating them lead to a good outcome. So we need this joint counterfactual outcome here. Another type of kind of question is, you know, what new content should we show to a user? So here we've kind of got some observations. So we saw that for a given type of content, they listened to it, they listened to lots of it over a certain time period and they really enjoyed it. And now in that context, next, we can ask the counterfactual question. Had they indeed listened to a different type of content, what would have happened to them given the kind of observation of their past kind of listening history and so forth? So this is where kind of counterfactuals give us a more nuanced way to make personal decisions, because we can take extra observations about past interactions and so forth. And that updates our knowledge about any unobserved confounders and allows us to kind of reason more accurately given uncertainty and so forth. So there are many more examples, but there's kind of two prominent ones of, you know, why we're interested in counterfactuals. So that kind of concludes the kind of talk today. The main take homes, I guess, are, you know, we really need to answer, you know, lots of different varied counterfactual or causal questions to be able to do actionable decision making in the real world. There's loads of new problems, you know, many ones I didn't kind of mention today that we don't know the right way to answer at the moment. So there's loads of research to do. And beyond that, there's loads more applications of causal inference at Spotify. And so if anybody's interested, please feel free to reach out. Always happy to chat about these things. Thanks very much.
Ilya, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for a great talk, Aaron. Would you mind, I have a very minor notational question for you. So would you mind going back to like the slides where you're talking about the hierarchy? You've got kind of a do statement in there, one of the slides. Yeah, this one. So what exactly does this mean? I'm a little confused.
So usually, if you would read, I guess, Causality by Pearl, how he would represent this would the do would be a subscript on the C to the left-hand side of the conditional symbol. So here he'd talk about, you know, what is a counterfactual, where he'd introduce some new notation. A counterfactual for some outcome or some variable Y will be Y sub X, where X is the cause of Y, and we intervene on X and we want to see how Y will respond. So when writing this slide initially, people weren't aware of this notation. So I simplified it a bit by just sticking the do in here. But if we were to do it more formally, the do would somehow be subsumed into a subscript for the first C to make it, I guess, more semantically sensible.
Right. Yeah. I have glanced at that book before. And I think like my understanding of the do notation in that book is that the do is defined on the joint. And then you perform the intervention first, you can do the conditioning later. Consequently, the way you have it written, I think it applies to both of these. Consequently, this is just probability zero event, right?
Yeah. So what I'm representing here is first we make an observation, subject has cancer in this case, then use that to update the kind of any latent distribution that might be in our model. And then in the context where we sample from this new updated posterior, we create a submodel, which is do intervention on S, and we kind of feed forward from S and sample from this updated posterior for lambda to get what the distribution for C would be in that context.
Yes, I understand. I'm just saying that as I understand the do notation, this is not what the do notation means as Pearl uses it. That's all. So that was my question. Thank you. I understand.
So Kieran, I have a question. Can you go back to the first topic, the short-term, long-term effect? I think that was the first time.
So this one here, or the one the intervention?
That's the one. You kind of motivated it with short term versus long term, but really I wouldn't have to think about it that way. I don't have to have a time scale. I mean, this just could be the causal graph in some situation. And so I'm curious, like, how general is this kind of technique, like thinking of the noise term on the mediary variable as an instrumental variable? It's important that it was a linear model. Can you do anything more general than in a linear model?
Yeah, no, it's a great point when kind of considering this in some senses, the natural generalization of the front door criterion, right? Can we do something here in this context? So yeah, so it, you know, it's super important that we have a linear model here, right? Because that's what allows us to really separate out the kind of noise term from all the other kind of things. Still non-trivial in the case where W impacts M, because there's still a correlation there. We need to remove that. But linearity allows us to remove it in some sort of straightforward way. In the paper, we looked at a kind of slight extension of this linear model to what's called post-linear models or partially linear models, where there's still some linearity, but it can the way in which a variable can, you know, depend on its causes can be nonlinear. So this is kind of weird combination of these things here. And in that context, we can still solve this problem, but we need lots of samples of data because the answer has really high variance because you pass it through these nonlinearities and so forth. But beyond that, like if we just have a general kind of causal model where, you know, a variable depends in some sort of nonlinear arbitrary functional way on both its, you know, observed parents and the noise terms and so forth, can we in this context figure out what's going on? Well, we probably could, given some assumptions about, you know, whether the functional dependence of the variable we care about is, you know, invertible and the way in which that inversion would enable us to get information about the noise term. Because if we can get information about the noise term or some sort of, you know, weird proxy of the noise term, then just given the structure of the DAG, then it is an instrumental variable, so we can use it as such. So if there are assumptions we can make to get at it in some way, even in nonlinear models, then we could use it as an instrumental variable.
Okay. Yeah, follow-up question here that, I mean, even if you didn't have like a local noise term on M, but that was actually a latent common cause of many other variables, I mean, you could still sort of use the tools of due calculus that if you could estimate that, then maybe you could figure out the causal effect you're interested in. So it feels like there's a prospect here for sort of a general technique where you would not just reduce to the instrumental scenario, but, you know, you might reduce to some other scenario where the causal effect you're interested in is identifiable or partially identifiable. So have you thought about that?
So not a huge amount. I mean, the main thing that kind of appealed to me about this was that we would, you know, actively use the noise terms in a way, because people usually, especially in economics, treat them as just some sort of, you know, exogenous variation outside our model that we kind of don't really want in there. But in some sense, at least in linear models, that's useful, right? We can use this external variation due to the noise term because it's by assumption somehow isolated as some way to kind of gain some causal insight that perhaps seemed like it was impossible to gain before because there's unobserved confounders. But we haven't kind of pushed that too much further than that kind of observation. But I think you're right in that, like, taking them more seriously should enable some sort of like tricks that could, you know, enable identification or at least partial identification in certain more general situations.
Great, thanks. We have a question, Stefan.
Yeah, I just have a small question or comment like that is that I find this interesting, this particular diagram. I believe that in the epidemiology literature, there is a lot of there are books about surrogate analysis. And it's not necessarily, it could be a question of time, but the idea is that Y is expensive to observe. And therefore, you cannot sort of get it in trials, and then you do M instead, and so you make cheap trials that gives X, that gives the cheap randomized trials that gives identifies the causal effect of X of M, and then you're using that to combine with an analysis of the relationship between M and Y to give a full analysis. And I just wonder whether this idea in some sense, generally they would typically do that in binary type rather than in linear type arguments. But I believe this must be related. It's just a different name for what you do, right?
Yeah, no, 100%. So this kind of work started from that surrogate modeling thing, especially in economics literature, care about it as well. So Susan Athey and various collaborators have methods for kind of figuring out what's going on here, as you said, right? Given some observational data that tells us about the relationship of M on Y, then all I need to do is observe the impact of X on M, and then from that, put that into my model and then predict what the outcome for Y is. But the main assumption required for all of these works is that there's no unobserved confounders. So I can control myself for what, for, you know, any observed confounder and the relation between M and Y to figure out how Y causally depends on M. And then upon receiving what the impact of X on M is, I can then, you know, infer the impact of X on Y. Whereas the main thing we wanted to do here was say, okay, there can be unobserved confounders in my observational data set, which would mean we can't use these kind of surrogate models because we can't ever figure out. We can look at the correlation between M and Y, but we can't figure out the causal impact of M and Y. But it turns out that even in that case, again, when you assume linearity and so forth, that even when there's unobserved confounders, you can still solve this problem in that surrogate style approach, even when there's unobserved confounders.
But I guess, like in the instrumental situation, you can get balance.
Yes. So if yes, I see. So in that situation, we wouldn't necessarily have to impose. Well, we'd still need linearity to figure out what the noise term is. But then,
I think that Rubin, I actually don't like his analysis, but I think he introduces what he calls principal stratification, which are some counterfactuals, and he more or less uses them as an instrument.
Cool. Okay. So I guess it's, yeah, I mean, it's in some sense doing something somewhat similar here, right? Learning these kind of like influences from each of the kind of, you know, external things. When we remove the influence of X at certain levels, then we get, you know, NM, and that allows us to, even when there's unobserved confounders, treat it as an instrument to learn the impact, which I guess, yeah, when considering the standard surrogate literature, was the one thing that hasn't been done there, this unobserved confounder. But yeah, we should definitely check out that kind of work by Rubin, I suppose.
Rubin and Frankakis is the reference.
Cool.
Other questions? All right, well, let's thank Kieran again.